find that the goal of the productive argument isn't to get a specific reaction or a positive response. What you're looking for is a solution to the problem. Evolution. We grow through conflict by taking responsibility for our part in the issue, and we acknowledge our mistakes by apologizing. Even if you apologized early on, apologizing at the end, when you found a resolution, provides powerful closure. Of course, if it's done incorrectly, an apology can be as empty as the resolution to never do it again. As children, we were told, "Say you're sorry," and those words were presumed to fix the injury. But as adults, we need to do more than put a bandage on the problem. In a productive argument, the apology expresses more than regret. Through it, you restate the issue and commit to change. There are three steps to a real apology: acceptance, articulation, and action. Acceptance. First, the apologizer needs to feel true regret for their behavior or mistake, which involves recognizing how their choices affected the other person's feelings and taking responsibility for the outcome. Articulation. Next, the apologizer needs to communicate their understanding and regret with clear expression of the challenges and emotions involved. This doesn't mean making a big, lofty statement about how you'll never make the mistake again. Instead, you're expressing the behavioral change that you're going to make in order to ensure it doesn't happen again. You might say, "I recognize that when you're stressed, it's not useful for me to remind you of what you still have to do. Instead, I'm going to support you." Or you might say, "I'm sorry that in the beginning of our relationship, I belittled you, which made you feel disrespected and unloved and insecure. I'm taking steps to recognize why I do that and to be more supportive and compassionate in my communication with you. I'm going to try to think before I respond." Action. Finally, we honor our commitment to avoid making the same mistake again. Follow through on this promise of change is the most important outcome of the argument. As I've heard said, the best apology is changed behavior. Your partner might take their cue from how meaningful you've made your apology and reciprocate with their own. But if they don't, it might be because they need time. You can set up the opportunity for them to articulate their own apology in their own time by saying, "Does it help to know exactly what I'm sorry for? I'd appreciate your thoughts after you have time to reflect on this." Try this. Write an apology letter. Sit down and think about everything you could apologize to your partner for. Anything and everything you still feel sorry about. This is not about making yourself feel better or putting yourself down. It's about taking responsibility for your mistakes, making your partner aware that you reflect on how you've affected them, and validating feelings you should have seen but may have missed. It shows them how much you care. For each mistake, list 1. The mistake itself. 2. How you think it affected them. 3. Why you feel sorry. 4. How you will fix it or what you intend to do differently going forward. Don't qualify your apology with blame, explanations, or excuses. You already explained yourself when you were working through the issue. Now your focus is showing that you understand how you hurt your partner. After you've written your note of apology, give it to your partner. Let them know that you wrote this without any expectations of what they might do in return. You just wanted to express your love in a new way by thinking seriously about old feelings or mistakes or resentments that may have never been addressed or resolved. The deal breaker. Sometimes peace is elusive. an argument feels irreconcilable. Neither person will budge, and neither of you is happy with the rift in your relationship. If nobody's changing, then you're both going to have to find a way to make peace with it, or have the same fight over and over again. Psychiatrists Philip Lee and Diane Rudolph, a husband-wife team of relationship experts, say that couples can get in a habit of arguing without resolution, what they term argument addiction, where the couple is stuck in a pattern of communication which can send them on a seemingly endless loop over the same arguments. That doesn't sound like fun. Instead of this issue being a zone you either avoid or fight over repeatedly, this topic might have to be a neutral zone, a space where you agree to respect each other's opinions and not try to change them. That's different from just being angry and not talking about an issue. In some, perhaps many cases, we can learn to accept these differences. They don't have to hurt the relationship. For example, your partner may never be excited about going to that big work party or dancing in a flash mob with you because they're deeply introverted and prefer quiet events with opportunities for intimate conversation. That may be okay. Unsolvable doesn't need to be a discouraging term, but rather may indicate that the issues won't go away because the sources of conflict won't go away. In such cases, you can negotiate solutions that work for both of you. Find a friend who will go to the party or the mosh pit with you, or agree to attend in exchange for doing something she loves that doesn't delight you. There are also difficult topics where you must find a way to agree, like how to manage the family's finances, where to send the kids to school, or what to do if your partner has to be involved with an ex because they have children together. With the tools I've given you and a positive intention, you can likely navigate these arguments. But approaching an issue together and looking for ways to fight it out as a team doesn't guarantee that you'll get the reaction or resolution that you want. When you continue to bump up against a significant, complex issue, and you're far from mutual ground, then you might find yourself confronting a deep rupture in your relationship. This is when our fights lead us to the biggest question we faced since we first decided to get together. Should we remain together? This is a challenge that we will address in the next rule. Rule 7. You don't break in a breakup. Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. Rumi. Signs of trouble. Love doesn't disintegrate overnight. The early days of your relationship were like a freshly painted wall. Smooth, even, ready to be filled with images of the life that awaited you. The wall underneath may not have been perfect, but with the fresh coat of paint, it looked nice and solid. But every wall eventually gets scratches. Maybe even some from baggage that arrived on move-in day. Perhaps you've been too busy to deal with it. Maybe you told yourself it wasn't a problem, but you've just been saying that to smooth things over. You know the scratches won't go away until you do something about them, but you can live with them for a while. Then, over time, more scratches accumulate. You walk past them every day. If they start to bother you, you might do some touch-up. Maybe you'll even decide it's time to repaint that wall. In the same way, flaws emerge in relationships. The hustle of life generates scratches and nicks that won't go away unless you address them. Maybe your partner always leaves the gas tank on empty. Maybe they spend too much time telling you how much their boss annoys them. Maybe they complain every time you have to visit your parents. What each person sees as a scratch will be different, but these are all small issues. You could touch them up if you wanted to, and that knowledge should give you the confidence to live with them. But you must be willing to accept them as part of the charm of a lived-in house. Every flaw doesn't mean the walls will collapse. If we treat every scratch like an earthquake, we put unnecessary stress on the relationship. In other words, pettiness stretches scratches into cracks. A crack in a wall suggests a structural problem that needs addressing and shouldn't be ignored for too long. Examples of cracks in a relationship might be that you repeatedly break promises to change a behavior, or you consistently feel uncomfortable around one of their family members but don't feel supported, or you feel like the relationship is on autopilot. You never talk anymore. If there is a crack in the relationship, you can't let this issue go unresolved. We talked about how to work through everyday scratches and cracks in the previous chapter. Sometimes you look at the wall of your house and you know there's a real problem that can't be solved by a paint job. The building structure is compromised, and the jagged line that crosses the wall is only a symptom of the major underlying problem. In this case, either the two of you are going to find a way to make repairs, or there's going to be a breakup. Let's touch on a few examples of major ruptures that need to be addressed one way or another. Abuse, infidelity, inertia, disinterest. Abuse is a deal breaker. First, I want you to know that you deserve to be safe. If you don't feel safe, whether physically, emotionally, or both, the question isn't whether to go, it's how to leave safely. Abuse is any behavior that one partner uses to control the other, and control has no place in a relationship. The National Domestic Violence Hotline identifies 6 categories of abuse: physical, emotional and verbal, sexual, financial, digital, and stalking. Physical threats and violence to you, your children, your family, or your pets are the most obvious signs of abuse. But any of the following are common signs of abuse. Your partner interferes with your decision-making. They tell you how you can spend your time, including whether you can work and when you can and can't go out. They tell you what you can and can't wear. They tell you who you can spend time with. They show extreme jealousy and try to control how much time you spend with family and friends. They use hurtful language, looks, and gestures, insulting, demeaning, or threatening you in private or in front of other people. They control money, restricting what you have and what you can spend it on. They control sex, pressuring you to have sex or perform acts you don't like. None of this is partnership. It's ownership. It can be very difficult and scary to leave relationships where someone is controlling us. When abusive people are stripped of control, they can become dangerous. Yet if you're in a physically or emotionally abusive relationship, you need to find a safe way out. If you're in this situation, my first recommendation is always, again, to seek professional help. Please contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline, 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Fear can be a factor even when it doesn't tip into abuse. You may find that in your relationship, you walk on tiptoe because you're scared of provoking your partner. You anticipate a negative reaction from them and find yourself overthinking how you'll respond. The reaction we're trying to avoid might be straight up anger, but it can also be derision and criticism. Constructive criticism is valuable when it's coming from a guru with calmness and good intentions. You don't want to have a life full of yes people. But if your partner demeans you to your face or behind your back, this doesn't help you grow. If your partner is habitually careless or aggressive in their words to you, or vice versa, it takes a measurable toll on your relationship. According to research by psychologists Clifford Norterius and Howard Markman, it takes just one aggressive or passive-aggressive remark to erase 20 acts of kindness. When your relationship contains fear and criticism, it's hard to feel free to be yourself. You're putting on a performance to make you and the relationship match your partner's requirements. There's a level of performance in many of the roles we play and jobs we have. To greater or lesser degrees, we often call on a slightly controlled, enhanced, or trained version of ourselves to adjust to different circumstances. We can't expect to feel fully ourselves in every situation every day, but with our partner, we shouldn't feel like we're living a lie. You don't have to instantly bail on the relationship if you realize you're operating out of fear. First, try sharing more of who you truly are. Start to break those illusions. You can say, "Hey, I know I said I like baseball, but I really don't. I'd rather not watch the games with you anymore." In most relationships, something like that probably wouldn't be a huge deal. But another situation could have much higher stakes. Maybe you'll have to say, "I know I said I don't want kids, but I wasn't really being honest. I thought that in time you'd change your mind. The truth is, I really want kids, and I'll feel I'm missing out if we don't have them." Or maybe you want to make a significant change in your everyday life, to relocate or pursue a new purpose. If you're deeply invested in the relationship, make a significant effort to express who you truly are. Being judged in the short term is better than being stuck in the wrong situation for the long term. If the only way for you to sustain the relationship is to pretend to be someone you're not, it's time to think about ending it. Don't view this journey as one you must undertake alone. Loneliness and isolation can keep us from making the tough choice to go. We may fear how our lives might change without that person or that situation. But others have suffered like you, and others are suffering now, and others have left. You may well need help, and there's no shame in recognizing that you're in a bad situation and asking for help and support. Somewhere inside, my friend Judy knew it was time to leave her husband. She told me, "I have no trouble making decisions at work. I've also prided myself on being clear-headed and sure of myself. But even though we were no longer happy, even though I bore his scorn and disrespect every single day, leaving the father of my children felt somehow beyond me." She hesitated to talk to her friends. "We've been together for 24 years. I was embarrassed to admit how long I'd been unhappy and how bad it had gotten. And I feel like sometimes friends just want you to stay together. It makes them feel more stable in their own marriages." Judy ended up turning to an online community of women that she'd joined only recently. "I didn't know them, and none of them were experts, but I was able to present my situation anonymously and as subjectively as I could. Their collective wisdom covered so many different aspects of what I was going through. My need for autonomy, my attachment to the past, my commitment to my wedding vows, my hopes for the future, my fears of being alone, my worries about my children, and my concerns that my husband's reaction might put our family in danger. Among the group, they'd been through it all. I came away almost surprised by how much clarity I had. Plus, they'd given me ways to communicate with my husband that never would have occurred to me with all the emotional buildup of the years. And they connected me with local resources to make sure I was safe. There's no reason to be alone when you make hard decisions and enter the unknown. Seek out supporters or experts, whether it's through online forums, books, friends, or organizations. You deserve love and respect, and your safety is non-negotiable. Infidelity is a profound challenge. One of the most common reasons people end relationships is cheating. According to data from community health centers, of couples where a partner had admitted to cheating, only 15.6% of relationships were able to recover. There are all sorts of issues that can lead to one partner betraying the other, and there are whole books on processing it. But there is no question that once trust is broken, only deep work and commitment on both sides can rebuild it. In Not Just Friends, psychologist and infidelity expert Dr. Shirley Glass writes that in the aftermath of cheating, it's natural to want to end the relationship immediately, and that may be the right decision. But it can be hard to tell when emotions are running hot. Even if you're still not sure whether the relationship can be saved, she writes, you shouldn't make your decision based on the lowest point in your relationship. To do the hard work ahead of exploring the meaning of the infidelity, you will need to build a foundation of commitment, caring, and compassionate communication. For the partner who was cheated on, that includes putting your own best foot forward. You and your partner can work together to create a healing atmosphere that is calm, where information can be shared and where caring begins to bind you together again. And you can start making specific repairs to the relationship that will help each of you feel more connected. In one survey of couples who had experienced infidelity, when the person who had cheated was willing to answer their spouse's questions honestly, 72% of them said they were able to rebuild trust. Also, in order to restore trust, the person who was cheated on has to forgive. According to marriage and family therapist Jim Hutt, if the partner who was cheated on continues to punish and scold the other partner, the relationship is doomed. So if you find yourself in a situation where you're punishing the other person, you're also punishing yourself. Nobody expects you to summon instant forgiveness. But recognize that even though the other person broke your trust, you both have to put effort into restoring it. In some cases, couples say that healing after infidelity has resulted in even more trust than before. So it is possible to heal. But it takes total commitment from both partners. And it takes time. Glass notes that in a sample of 350 couples she worked with who experienced infidelity, those who attended at least 10 therapy sessions together had a much better chance of staying together than those who went to fewer sessions. If you're the one who cheated, don't leave your relationship for another person. Leave for you. If you betray your partner, you haven't taken the time to understand yourself. The two of you have built something together. If it's fallen apart, then leave. But let the dust settle before you find someone else. If you enter a new relationship while clouds of dust are still swirling around you, that debris will be caught up in the new relationship. You don't want to wind up in another mess with the same issues. Licensed clinical social worker Robert Tybee talks about why rebound relationships seem so appealing. Once the relationship is over, there's a void in your life. There's a loss and grief because the psychological attachment is broken. It's easy to have tunnel vision, Tybee says, looking only at the bad in the relationship and your partner, and so you think the solution is easy. Find someone who isn't like that. But of course, you're still the same person you were in your last relationship, so some of the challenges will come along with you. In fact, research by sociologist Annette Lawson shows that just 1 in 10 people who left their marriage for another person actually ended up marrying the person with whom they'd had an affair. Try this. Check your reasons for leaving. Are you truly doing this for you? Or have you been dazzled by a shiny new person? Check yourself. Considerations. 1. Temptation check. If you hadn't met the new person, would you stay with your current partner? If the answer is yes, then you should focus on resuscitating the relationship. 2. Reality check. If a magician tells you how they did a trick, the trick is not as enchanting. A new relationship is full of magic, but it doesn't tell you what's left when the magic fades. Assume the clean slate of your relationship with the new person will develop its own fissures. Are you prepared to work on them as they arise? Or will you find yourself with the same frustration and disillusion? 3. Karma check. Remember that if you leave for someone else, your new partner might do the same to you. Make sure that if you leave, it's because you genuinely believe there is no future with your partner and that you would rather be alone than with them. Loss of interest. Divorce lawyer Joseph E. Cordell says one problem he often sees is a lack of day-to-day communication, where spouses never shared or discussed the things going on in their lives. That can make your partner feel like they're not a significant part of your life. After you've been married for 10 years, you might not be hurrying to the door to greet your partner after work. But in general, you should think of seeing them as a positive experience. There's something wrong if, when their name pops up as an incoming call, you decline it. It's really important to ask yourself, why am I avoiding that call? One of the reasons we avoid someone is that we don't want to spend time hearing about their life. We no longer recognize what's interesting about them because we haven't connected for so long. This is hard to admit to ourselves because we like to believe we are caring and constant. In order to fully evaluate this, ask yourself if there are people in your life that you do reach out to, people in your life that you're excited to be around and excited to talk to. This will help you evaluate whether this is a widespread issue for you or whether it's something that relates to this particular relationship. Also notice whether this feeling is ongoing or whether it's just a phase. You'll know that your feelings toward your partner have permanently changed if you never look forward to seeing them. Even if you're not avoiding your partner, it's still a bad sign if you feel drained and unenthusiastic when you spend time with them. Another sign of waning interest is that you don't instantly want to share good or bad news with your partner. Think about who comes to mind when you have good news to share. If your partner isn't in the top 3, then this probably means either you don't feel that they're important enough to share it with, or you feel they won't care enough. When we stop sharing intimate information with people, it's because we no longer feel an intimate connection with them. Of course, it may be that certain types of good news aren't core to your partner's values. They don't have to be happy for you that you bought a new sweater. But in general, you should feel that seeing you happy makes them happy, and seeing you sad makes them want to comfort you. A sure sign that interest has faded is that you no longer feel like you have anything to learn from each other. Marriage and family therapist Marilyn Huff describes a couple in her practice who stopped growing together. Jane was training to become a therapist, and Tom was an engineer and sole provider for the family. He felt Jane's desire to become a therapist was a waste of time. Jane felt unseen by her husband, and Tom felt unsupported in his work. They had stopped growing together, and Huff says that by the time they came to therapy, the growth gap was just too big to overcome. Too many years had passed without communicating their true feelings and desires. From that point, it wasn't about trying to repair the relationship, but negotiating a conscious and caring breakup. When one or both partners are no longer putting effort into the relationship, either or both may have fallen out of love. This might well be difficult for the one who lost interest to explain. It is also a hard truth to hear and understand. No relationship is perfect all the time. But when challenges do arise, notice if you're the only one trying to fix them. Atrophy of intimacy. Sometimes the primary challenge in a relationship isn't an intolerable disagreement or behavior. Sometimes what we're facing is a matter of disconnection. In the beginning, a relationship is full of sparks. We feel attraction. We feel a positive flow of energy. Then, as time passes, that initial excitement inevitably wanes and we miss it. We still love our partner, but we question why things aren't what they used to be and whether we should feel as connected as we once did. A client of mine says she has friends she can talk to for hours, but she doesn't know what to talk to her girlfriend about. She asked me if that meant her girlfriend wasn't the one. I told her that in the same way a plant needs sun, water, soil, nutrients, and shelter, we need to keep tending our relationship for it to flourish over time. You may say, well, why don't I just buy a new plant? But if you move on, you'd have to learn to water that plant every day too. Nurturing intimacy. We nurture intimacy in our relationships by learning and growing together. I know a lot of couples who say they have nothing in common. If they sat together at dinner, they would have nothing to talk about. At times like this, we tend to default to negativity. We gossip or criticize or complain about the people we encounter or things we do. As a quote attributed to Eleanor Roosevelt goes, great minds discuss ideas. Average minds discuss events. Small minds discuss people. When we connect on negative issues, we generate a low vibration, a low energy that doesn't last long or create satisfaction. When we connect in a neutral manner over routine matters like schedules or chores, we generate a medium vibration that doesn't foster intimacy and love. But when we experiment together, learning from and through each other, we generate a high vibration that energizes and stimulates our connection. If you can't generate a high vibration, it might be because you don't have any new thoughts to share. You aren't spending time developing yourself. You aren't reading or absorbing new art or ideas. You will never be able to reset or refresh a relationship if you keep doing the same old thing over and over again. Repeating activities may feel comfortable and relaxing, but you don't learn anything new about your partner through familiar routines. On the other hand, if you're growing, you can help your partnership grow. Intimacy develops and thrives when we disclose more, when we try out ideas and let ourselves be vulnerable. This deepens our bond. You can't order new thoughts and philosophies on Postmates. You open up your world by exploring with your partner. intimacy is created through shared adventures, entertainment, experiences, and experiments, and education, all of which are aimed at the same outcome. A shared experience lets us reflect, share our opinions, and see if we're in agreement. We learn about each other and with each other. Before the pandemic, Radhi and I used to host events at our home where we'd invite our closest friends to a deep, beautiful meditation. We both place a high value on meditation and spirituality, and those events allowed us to serve our friends together. Radhi would plan the menu and the decor, while I did the guest list and the invite, making sure that all the logistics were taken care of. After the event was over and everyone went home, we'd feel joyful and grateful that we had pulled it off together. We may be achieving things in our own personal lives and careers, but our relationships hunger for us to achieve together. Those events helped build our community, and at the same time, they gave our relationship purpose. Entertainment. At the end of a long day, most of us feel like we're too tired to do anything other than curl up in front of the TV. We're often overworked and exhausted and gravitate to entertainment as the easiest way to connect with our partner. If you got into the habit of watching more TV during quarantine, you're not alone. My own guilty pleasure is the real estate show Selling Sunset. If you're going to watch TV, there are ways you can get more intimacy out of it. First of all, don't multitask while you're doing it. Stay off your laptop or phone so that you're present with your partner as you watch together. Pick something engaging and chat about it afterward. We don't have to force our partners to deliver an elaborate critique, but you can make an effort to ask them questions about what they took away from the show to keep you both engaged and connected. Entertainment is only one of three categories I suggest here. I'm not saying you can never do that, but if you use it to fill 100% of your spare time together, don't be surprised if you run out of things to talk about. Your brain might appreciate it if you push yourself to get out. A little effort is worth it to deepen intimacy. Experiences and experiments. Experiences and experiments require more planning and energy than entertainment, but the rewards are worth it. Afterward, you can share your thoughts and reviews with each other. Experiences don't have to be far-flung, expensive, or wild. This could be a book launch, a magic show, an art show, live music at a bar. You can visit a farmer's market, take a cooking class, go wine tasting, take a dance class, plan a picnic, go for a hike, drive to see seasonal decorations, or take a walk after dinner. Don't drag the other person to an event that only interests you. Look at the local listings and find something that intrigues both of you and takes you out of your comfort zone. Every one of these activities helps you learn about your partner, feel safe with them, and rekindle intimacy. This gives your relationship the space and resilience to deal with important matters as they arise. You can plan a vacation together. Schedule time every week to discuss likes and dislikes, whether you'd rather experience a new city by night or rent an Airbnb in the desert, whether you want to schedule meals and activities in advance or to wing them. A 2000 study commissioned by the U.S. Travel Association, no bias there, found that couples who travel together are significantly happier and healthier in their relationship. 86% of couples who travel together said that their romance was alive, and 63% believe that traveling actually inspires romance. And 68% of couples believe that traveling together for leisure is necessary for a healthy relationship. According to the report, traveling helped people prioritize each other. When you get away together, you're better able to set aside your other obligations and focus on each other. Every month, Radhi and I try to take time away together. It can be a local getaway or just a day trip if that's all you can manage. Traveling together is not just about going to a new place. Being in a place without distractions helps couples go deeper and become closer. Serving together, doing charity work together, volunteering together. These activities are deeply connected to my time living as a monk. Half of our time as monks was spent in silence, self-awareness, and study. And the other half was spent in service, trying to make a difference in the world. I know couples that have met while volunteering, and others who regularly volunteer together, and they all tell me it's such a beautiful experience. Radhi and I consistently serve together, whether it's organizing charity events, feeding the homeless, or gathering in a group to learn from an expert. Like music and sex, the act of service increases our oxytocin levels. It has also been shown to reduce levels of stress and create social connection. It's easy to connect when you're not just trying to help each other or to help others, but to help others together. We gain perspective on real-life issues. We experience gratitude together. We feel a higher purpose together. A 2017 Wallet Hub survey found that married couples who volunteer together were more likely to stay together. We don't just bond over movies and TV shows. We bond over beliefs and a shared sense of mission. Some of the best experiences are experiments, when you and your partner set out to try something new together. You don't just learn something new, you learn about yourself and your partner. The more vulnerable you are when you experiment, the more intimacy you'll feel. A study by psychologist Arthur Aaron and colleagues found that couples who spent time together doing new and exciting activities were able to improve their connection and bond. Seek out adventures that aren't in either of your areas of expertise. You don't want to attempt a sport where one of you has a natural advantage, or to play a game that one of you has played for years. To build intimacy, you want to both be novices so that you feel inexperienced and curious together. You both feel similarly uncomfortable. You're both going to learn something new. You're going to need and rely on each other. A challenging hike, a visit to a haunted house, spelunking, roller skating, or, my favorite, an escape room. Intimacy builds as you expose yourselves to each other in a vulnerable moment. Once Radhi and I went to a paint room where they had easels, canvases, brushes, and paints. We were given overalls to wear, and they let us go crazy. It was new and liberating to spray paint wherever we wanted and to create without worrying about the end product. Another time, we went to a rage room full of bottles, trash cans, old computers, and broken fax machines. We were handed metal pipes and baseball bats and given free rein to break stuff in order to de-stress. Radhi and I were hesitant. We're not violent people. On our way out, we felt more stressed than we had been going in. Activities like this are a microcosm of the relationship. They don't just help you play a game, they actually teach you about your relationship without having to make it serious. Research shows that play is the mental state in which we learn best, and that play is essential for our mental health. When you attempt a new and challenging activity together, in a space where success doesn't matter, you can both let go and learn. Not only do you realize your relationship's weaknesses, but you see your strengths. You get to practice making mistakes together in a situation where the stakes are low. When you accomplish something new together, you bring that experience to all areas of your life. New activities are especially bonding when they take you out of your comfort zone. Something daring or challenging, whatever that may be for you, Whether it's a bucket list item like skydiving or jet skiing or conquering your fear of heights. Arthur Aaron and Don Dutton hired an attractive woman to interview men who had just crossed a very high, somewhat unstable, though not actually dangerous bridge, along with men who had just crossed a normal, stable bridge. In each case, she asked them some questions, told them if they wanted to talk further, they could call her, and gave them her number. Of those who had just crossed the shaky bridge, 9 of 18 called her. Of those who had crossed the stable bridge, only 2 of 16 called. Aaron and Dutton used the study to point to the misattribution of arousal. The men experienced physical arousal or not because of the bridge, and it had a halo effect on the woman. But what if the men were simply emboldened by a rush of confidence after having crossed the bridge? In a follow-up study aimed at clarifying the results, the researchers generated physical arousal by telling male participants that as part of the study, they would receive an electrical shock. Some were told this shock would be mild, and some were told it would be painful. Again, an attractive woman, ostensibly also a participant, was present. Participants were told that it would take the researcher a few minutes to set up the shock device, and were asked to fill out several questionnaires while they waited. One questionnaire assessed their level of attraction to the woman who was participating in the study with them. As it turned out, those who anticipated receiving the painful shock experienced significantly more attraction than those who anticipated only a mild one. This research points to why novel and exciting things, anything that arouses our senses, can help to revive and refresh our interest in our partner. Their takeaway was that a small amount of stress can spur amorous feelings. We don't have to fear for our lives, but the novelty and excitement of something new or daring heightens our senses and can create strong feelings of romantic attraction. Dr. Lisa Mary Bobby, founder and clinical director of Growing Self Counseling and Coaching, says, "These shared moments become things to talk about and connect over time and time again. When you've lived through an experience together, it can show you how caring your partner is. If you're about to do something that's slightly daring and one of you is supporting the other, you may find that the roles reverse. Say you're about to go down a very high water slide. The person who is really confident on the way up might not be the same person who's confident going down. And you start to see how you both support each other. That's a beautiful feeling to experience with your partner in a context like this, because even though the stakes are low, you realize that your partner has that capacity for care. It's also possible that you see that there's no care, no attention, no empathy, no compassion, no support. If that's the case, then you can now see more clearly the void that's hampering your relationship." Education. The third way to build intimacy is through education. We talked about this option when either or both of you are trying to learn about your purpose. This may require the most time and effort, but it's a great way to support each other's growth. If you share the same interests, you can take a class together. Perhaps you want to take a seminar on real estate or a gardening class. Don't feel like you have to do exactly the same thing. You can each do your own thing and then share your learning. The point is to expand your own knowledge so you have something new to bring to the table. One last way to create intimacy? By expressing gratitude. When we slide into apathy with our partner, we often stop appreciating what they say, do, or achieve. As we've already discussed, you should thank your partner for cooking for you. You should thank your partner for moving the car so that you could leave on time. You should thank your partner for calling to check in. You should thank your partner for putting gas in the car. You should thank your partner for changing the batteries in the smoke alarm. You should thank your partner for going back to the other room to turn out the lights before bed. Why would we not take these opportunities? The more attention we pay to our partners, the more we appreciate their thoughtfulness, and the more likely we are to respond in kind. When they feel appreciated, they are thankful for our thoughtfulness and likely to keep being thoughtful and to reciprocate the appreciation. And so we experience a feedback loop of gratitude, where we each have more and more chances to feel love by performing simple tasks for our partners. Elevate or separate. If, in spite of our efforts to foster intimacy, our relationship faces one of these four or any other major structural threat, we have a choice. Love is imperfect, but that doesn't mean we should stay in an unhealthy relationship. Let's look at how to know if you should stay together, work on the issues, and find ways to grow, or if you should break up. There is no right answer. There are only two choices. We can continue with growth, choosing to elevate our relationship, or we can separate. There is actually a third option, and it's one that many people choose by default. We can continue as we are. Stagnation is never good. We should always be growing. But one way of growing is to accept things as they are. Sometimes we don't feel the way we used to about our partner because we're overworked and overwhelmed with responsibilities and don't have time to nurture our relationship. We might start to imagine there's someone better out there, someone we would never fight with and who would always entertain us. But it's not fair for our partner to have to compete with that fantasy. In this case, it makes sense to let go of the fantasy and stay the course. If your tolerance for managing conflict and stress is low, then it's hard to stay with anyone. Before we give up on a relationship, we should check to make sure we aren't expecting too much from our partner. If a friend was helping you move boxes, and you ask them to carry an extra large box, they might say, "I'm sorry, but I think it's too heavy for me." You would not take their refusal to help as a sign that they don't love you. They aren't equipped to give you the help you need. Our partners aren't necessarily equipped to support us in all areas of life. Your partner isn't Target, a one-stop shop for your every need. We talk about the need for a support system, but we never really talk or think about what that system should be. Try this. Build a support system. Identify people whom you can turn to for support in key areas of life. You can do this for yourself, but it's also something you can do alongside your partner, so you share an understanding of each other's support system. Self. Who do you turn to when you experience self-doubt, when you want to discuss your values, when you want to explore your spirituality, or when you want to celebrate your successes? Financial. Who can best advise you when you have questions about your career and income, and how to make financial decisions? Mental/emotional. What friends or resources can you turn to for mental health guidance and support? Health. Who can you go to with questions about your health? Who might be a good person to turn to if you have a health issue that's difficult to deal with either logistically or emotionally? Relationships. When you have struggles or conflicts with friends, family, colleagues, or your partner, who do you turn to for support and advice? Identifying your support system together will help you see where you're best at supporting each other, and where you can turn to others without guilt or shame on either side. Your relationship might have serious cracks that need fixing, but you want a better life together and you're willing and ready to figure out how to improve it. Perhaps there's an area where you don't fully trust your partner and you want to see if you can build trust. Or maybe you've spent time building intimacy and feel ready to address some of those issues that have been building up over time. You believe progress would benefit your partnership. In this case, you can choose to grow instead of choosing to leave, to elevate instead of separate. With clients, I've developed a 4-step process to help you figure out if an issue is truly intolerable and you should break up, or whether, since you're hoping to elevate, you can find a way to see the issue differently and to eventually accept it. We start by identifying an intolerable issue. This is a difference between you and your partner that might be a deal breaker. This is usually a recurring point of frustration that you think might lead to the end of your relationship. Then we take this issue down a path, from intolerable to tolerable, to understanding to acceptance. Sometimes we even find our way to appreciation, where we end up admiring our partner for something we once found intolerable. The journey from intolerance to acceptance is about how patient you can be, and how much, with the honesty and commitment of your partner, you can change your perspective. Despite our best efforts, some behaviors or circumstances may remain intolerable at the end of this process, which is how you know you need to separate. Even if your efforts don't pan out, you'll know you tried your best. And if you don't want to bother, then either you'll continue as you are, or you'll decide to separate. Intolerable. I have a client, Sonia, whose husband, Rohan, insisted on leasing an expensive car instead of paying down their credit card debt. They had 2 children, and she was concerned not only about their financial situation, but that he was modeling irresponsibility and materialism to their kids. This was, for her, an intolerable issue, a rupture that had been forming for some time, and she couldn't imagine continuing to live this way. Other examples might be having a partner whose job requires them to work long hours, and you want a partner who is more present. Perhaps they expect you to have an old-school relationship where one partner works and the other manages the household, and that isn't what you had in mind. Or what if they dream of spending every vacation exploring a new city while you just want to collapse on the beach and you can't picture how you will spend your leisure time if you stay together? Or maybe they can't control their spending and they're running you into debt. These examples show varying degrees of disagreement, and you're bound to confront ruptures like this in your relationships. Sometimes they will break you up, and sometimes, in a relationship you are determined to protect, they will open your mind. Like my client with the car-loving husband, your impulse might be to feel that there is no way you can bridge this gap unless the other person changes the intolerable behavior. The first question to ask yourself is, do you love this person enough to deal with some discomfort as you work through the issue? If the answer is no, there is no way you can live with this issue no matter what, and it's never going to change, then you simply don't care for this person enough to work it out. Tolerable. My client Sonia was not willing to give up on Rohan. He wasn't irresponsible and materialistic in other ways, and she was willing to make the journey to figure out just what was going on with the car. She wanted to understand why he was so stubborn about this particular issue. The first step on the journey from intolerable to acceptance is when, however begrudgingly, you acknowledge that there might be some way of dealing with the issue. You believe the two of you can figure it out somehow, even if you have no idea how. This admission alone shifts the issue from intolerable to tolerable. You're willing to invest time to understand what this person has been through, and how this difference between you emerged from what they experienced. They are willing to explain themselves and seek understanding. This is how your capacity for empathy grows. Understanding. When Sonia opened up the conversation with Rohan about the car, making it clear she was only trying to understand, she learned that when he was young, he took 3 buses to school, and it was an embarrassment to him. His friends' parents drove them to school in nice cars, and he had vowed that he would never let his kids feel the way he had felt. Sonia still didn't agree with him, but now she felt compassion for his behavior. It wasn't reckless, it had deep emotional roots. Now she can bring her understanding to the discussions they have about the car. She can help him heal, instead of making him feel torn between his need and her dissatisfaction. They haven't solved the issue yet, but they are further on the path. According to marriage and family therapist Dr. John Gottman, 69% of marriage conflicts are about ongoing problems and never get resolved. We tire of the same confrontations and we give up trying without ever coming to any kind